So originally I came to the US in 77 in the spring and worked with IBM in Yorktown Heights, which is up north of New York City, Westchester.
Yeah.
And I was sent to Wisconsin as the outpost where IBM had a beamline. And this was the old ring that's County B and part of it in the Smithsonian now. I spent I think half a year out east or more to get the apparatus ready, and then moved to Wisconsin for about 3 years or so. And then early in the 80s, Brookhaven started building a ring, and then since that's a lot closer from IBM, IBM moved the whole beamline, including me, back east. And so then I did many years, 15 years or so, work at Brookhaven. And in 95 I came back to Madison as a professor, and that's when I started again.
Okay.
So I don't have any knowledge of this interim period.
Okay. Maybe you could tell me about what you did with Dave Huber. He really stressed the organizing the SRC so that it was more appealing to the NSF, and he showed me the binder that he created and all those things like that.
Yeah, so when I came, you know, then Dave Huber was in charge, and actually I think just after I came there was a renewal proposal that was denied by the NSF, but they gave the SRC another chance to submit a better proposal.
Do you know what year that was?
95. And so I remember one of my first, this renewed proposal may have been a year later, 96 or so, but at any rate, I remember we all had a trip to Washington, and Dean Eastman was there, my former boss, and whom you probably, at IBM, whom you probably encountered a lot in interviews, Juan Carlos Campuzano was there, Dave, of course, and Ed Rowe was still around, since he came in on a wheelchair. It was a little bit like Stephen Hawking coming around. And then that second attempt made it, so that the SRC got more focused, and that made it, and so since then. And then my role was basically, I didn't want to be involved in management. I was at IBM for a number of years in management, but management is not my cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like more the research and finding things and discovering things. And so I didn't want to get involved with SRC management. So it took a long time until people sort of nudged me a little bit in this direction. I said, I'm not going to do real director, because that's business mostly, and people, personnel, activities, finances, things that have nothing to do with physics. But I agreed to be scientific director, and so I was for about 5 years or so. I can give you the exact times. You can find it in my website, on my biography.
Okay.
It says for how many years. So I was the scientific director, and we tried to kind of overhaul things a little bit. So I think it was when the new newsletter was introduced, the electronic newsletter, and that's when we had a brochure. I'm not sure if you still have copies of that around, but everyone else, you know, the fancy big labs had these glossy brochures.
Yeah,
when we
yeah.
went to the NSF, we saw that their desks were full of all these fancy brochures. We said, we have to have one too.
Yeah,
And so I learned a lot about how to produce graphics and electronic publishing, although I had a lot of help too. So that was one of my first sinks of time to produce that. But then, as a scientific director, you also have to try to start new projects. And so I was trying to start the electron spectroscopy with the Sienta analyzers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took a lot of time to actually get the instrumentation going or get the staff to get the instrumentation far enough. You know, that eventually became a very successful, and now in the last sort of 5 years it carried most of the high profile work done at the SRC, last 5-10 years maybe. So that's my two experiences. The first time that the old Tantalus rang, and the second time that the Aladdin, but already at a fairly mature stage.
What year did you say you were at Tantalus?
So there I was basically at the outpost running the IBM beamline. So you could call it a beamline scientist, but I was a postdoc. That was sort of my official position. I was making sure everything runs, and then when Dean Eastman, my boss, and his many collaborators, good collaborators from all over the place, from Germany, Sweden, France, Canada, you name it, all over the U.S. So there was always a lot of activity, and that was my job to keep things running. So a little bit like what Tom Miller does now for Tai Cheng. So I have some pictures from that, from the more recent things. But then, you know, maybe some of these pictures illustrate a little bit what was going on at that time in the first early years, because there are not that many people now remembering that time. Most of them are, you know, retired or passed away already. But one thing, can you just move over here? It gives you an idea of the kind of spectroscopy that a lot of people were doing. Neville Smith is also one of these people. He was a bit more senior than me, 1 or 2 years, but he was in the labs. So at some point later on, we wrote an article in Physics Today together on this photoelectron spectroscopy. And it turns out, so here you see a little bit. This is these spectrometers. And Neville Smith liked a simple approach. So this was sort of wired together by hand, spot welded. And Dean Eastman liked the fancy high-tech approach. So we had some really complicated things. These were the world's biggest channel plates. Have you heard of channel plate detectors? No. So an electron multiplier, you know, like a photomultiplier, basically multiplies electrons by a million by bouncing it off back and forth, and each time having 10 secondary electrons coming off for one primary. And so that's the same idea, but you want to also do imaging. So photomultiplier just measures how many photons hit it, but not where they hit it. And so a channel plate typically is about this large, and it has lots of little channels. And the electrons just bounce back and forth to the end of the channel, and each time they enhance by a factor of 10, and so you get again a million or 10 million in gain. And so you can actually see single electrons with your naked eye. When you look at, you put at the end, you put a phosphor screen like this. And if you're dark adapted, you can see single electrons. You know, when you do quantum physics, then so esoteric, you know, electrons are these really there, you can see single electrons. And it's used a lot, you know, in night vision goggles, for example. If you see on TV all these, from Iraq or Afghanistan, these night vision, it's always a sort of a camera that images onto a photocathode, and then there's a channel plate that amplifies it. So this is something, you know, space technology and pretty high tech at that time. So this was late 70s. And then basically what we were doing, we're trying to map out the solids. You know, in your solid state course, you always learn that electrons described by energy bands, that was a theoretical concept for decades. I mean, pretty soon after quantum mechanics was formulated, but nobody had measured any energy band until the late 70s. And so with this photo mission, you could for the first time really measure what an energy band was that these theory books were always talking about, and even the textbooks, but nobody had actually seen them. And so these are the data points, and there's some calculations and so on. And that was the big thing then. And there's also some work was going on, for example, in diamond versus graphite. This is what we these days call NEXAFs. So that's with photo emission, you do Einstein's the experiment that Einstein mm-hmm. explained and got his Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, photon in, electron out. But here, what you do is you look how much photons are absorbed. And it's like when you do optical spectroscopy with a visible spectrograph, or so that you just look at which color, how much is absorbed. Mm-hmm. Except here we are not at 2 eV in the grain, but we are at 200, and this is sort of what's called soft X-rays. And there we go from a deep inner level. And so you see, for example, you can very easily distinguish, although both are carbon, the difference between graphite and diamond. And the reason is graphite has double bonds, diamond has only single bonds. And you see the empty orbitals. And here, for example, these are the empty orbitals of the double bond, this is the pi star. And these are empty orbitals of the single bond. So you can see that very nicely. And right now I'm working with two grad students doing the same type of experiment, but with fancy organic compounds for solar cells and so on. So this is sort of a real early view of what people are still doing. This is sort of the mainstream research.
When did this come out?
So that was in... Let's see here, I have to get one of the glasses. Probably says... It was in the mid-80s, so 85, I would guess. Yeah, it says December 85. Physics Today is a little bit different because they don't have a volume number. So it's December 85, and the page number is page 2, I was in the beginning. And these are sort of these overview articles that sort of I usually very tell the more general educated, well, in this case, maybe not the educated public, but the physicists who are interested in more broader overview, not the specialists. And the interesting thing was Japan has a magazine called Parity, and it's basically a large part a reprint from Physics Today. And so they picked it up, they liked it, and you see it was a year later. And so here, so here's our article in Japanese. I wouldn't understand the word, and I don't even know. I think the up, down, or right, left, or whatever it is with some of these things. And so that's the same article. You can see the pictures are the same, but it made it all way across the Pacific. and that was sort of some of the early stuff that people did, and. So in this old ring, one of the interesting parts is that there were sort of two groups, maybe three groups, were dominating the ring. One was the IBM group, then the Bell Labs group, and to some degree also Ward Plummer's group from University of Pennsylvania. But IBM and Bell Labs were always in competition with each other. And who could do better, and those were the two premier research labs in the world at the time, and so there was always this competition. And so what I found is a bunch of cartoons that you probably encountered Franco Cherina.
No, I haven't.
No, I would definitely ask him. He was here just last week for thesis defense. But he's now in Boston. He moved last semester, but he was many years here from the 70s until last year. And he was in electrical engineering, but he's also a very good draftsman and cartoonist. And so here are sort of, these cartoons are really captured the spirit. And I scanned them in, so I can send you electronic files. Great. But you see, this was made on graph sheets, papers. You won't see that anymore. And this was basically the millimeter sheet. That's where all the data were made with ink. And so here on one side of the beamline, these are the Seiya monochromators that you still have now at the ring. They have this very characteristic angle. It's an optical constraint. And so here is So here's Bell Labs symbol sitting here with a CBS TV camera, and here's IBM sitting, that didn't come through too well, with an ABC camera. And with these fancy spectrometers, you could now, because you could take a spectrum on each point of this channel plate, you could, you know, take a sort of, instead of one spectrum, you took maybe 100 by 100, mm-hmm. so you took 10,000 spectra simultaneously. And so that really enormously sped up data taking. All these Sienta analyzers have the same method now. And so basically here, there was this thing that, you know, IBM says 60,000. Now here it goes with 200 EDCs' energy distribution curve. So that's your normal photoelectron spectrum. Mm-hmm. And so 200 per hour, then they count, now they start 100 per hour, they count 200 per hour, 1,000, 2,000, so that was sort of the competition between the big labs. But actually, me and Neville were from both labs, so we sort of collaborated. So Neville passed away, I think, a couple of years ago, and you find there's some obituary and ALS website, and somewhere there's also a website in general. They had a special symposium, but I couldn't find that. And I think one of the pictures that I found, I think that is Neville Smith, although in very young years. I'm not sure, but I suspect it is. But I think that's probably the top view. So that may be the Bell Labs beamline from that time. So these things, I just have the things. If you have a way to scan them in.
Yeah, actually I do.
And then, so here's some of the IBM team. So this is me in younger years. This is Tai Cheng, who is still, you know, have you talked with him already?
No, I haven't.
At Urbana. So he has been a long time here. So he's a professor there for many years. This is Masa Ono. He came from Japan. This is Friso van der Veen. From the Netherlands. He runs the Swiss Light Source now. This is Günter Keindl, a professor already at the time from Berlin, but he's retired by now. So these were the people, and so we were standing here, and the apparatus was starting to get up into the air. And this is Dean Eastman, our boss. And this is part of this fancy spectrometer. There are some more kind of cartoons that give you a sort of an idea. So here is one, because these apparatuses got more and more complicated to take all these fancy spectra. So they grew up vertical, and you can see, you know, us already standing on the next level platform. And so he kind of exaggerated this as a mountain climbing gear. And so now the manipulator should be 3 feet south of the third CMA and down 1 feet. CMA is a special kind of spectrometer. So that was...
See
it? A little bit. And that was also characteristic. And now if you go to synchrotrons, you'll find that many of them have gone in several levels of platforms. Now, Dean Eastman, who is on the picture, had quite an influence because he bailed out financially the early version of the SRC. It wasn't called SRC, it was called Aladdin, the story chain. And Ed Rowe, of course, you know of him. And so Ed Rowe and Dean were closely working together. But sometimes I think probably got a little bit too, because Dean wanted to have some influence on, you know, wanted prime spot on the ring and what the ring should be doing. And so this is Ed Rowe with his mustache and beard from the back. And so damn it, we got to change its name too. And so Allah Dean. And let's see what else. I have one more, I think, of these. This I have only a slice, and I asked Chris, but he didn't have a slide scanner, so I don't know if you have any way of scanning things if you wanted. But at any rate, this one must have been scanned in because somebody wrote something down this picture. And that may be in the archive that is already in existence. But here's another cartoon. I don't know if you can see it, but there are a bunch of people looking under the table and above the cabinets.
Lost the beam.
So in the early days of any synchrotron, you keep losing the beam.
Yep.
So that's always was at that time an important part of life. And then when I moved to Brookhaven, actually, it was the same thing. And they have a beach nearby on Long Island, and they have also tennis courts. So we got a lot of beach and tennis court time because there was no beam. But then you had to be on alert, you know, there's beam, you know. Get off the beach, stop your match, and go take data until the beam dumps again. So it was the same thing. And at the ALS, which was the next generation ring in Berkeley, where we also built the beam line, and I have an operation since many years there. Usually we also had sort of the weekend plus Monday when they had machine time off, and so we always took off for the Sierras or something. So this is life at the synchrotron. Especially when they're not running. When they're running well, then you're just constantly sitting down there taking data. Yeah. It gets kind of boring, unless the data are interesting. So that's a little bit of the things here. The bottom shows a couple of these pictures that this analyzer. So you saw, for example, that the photoelectrons were not coming out in all directions from these crystals, but there were certain patterns to them. Mm-hmm. And it changed. This is all of silicon. This became a quite well-known paper on silicon surface states. And you see, depending on where you look, this is a little bit different energy. The three, they come out in completely different directions. And there was another surface state, this either dot or a little smoke ring. It's hard to see that the picture wasn't taken very well. But that picture, that image, that surface state, that's from copper, has been used a lot. For example, you may have seen from Don Eiger these quantum corals and the waves in them.
Yeah.
Yep. So this state, which was discovered in Norway and I think in the early 70s, and we used it here to test our spectrometer, that gives the ripples. So these are the wave functions of these electrons that you see in the quantum corals.
I was wondering, maybe you could, since I've been doing this, I've become very familiar with the events that have happened. And I'm interested in if you can talk to me about your feelings about just Aladdin as a whole compared to the other accelerators, especially with your experience at other labs.
Yeah.
Maybe about its place relative to the other accelerators.
So I think Tantalus, I can both talk Tantalus and Aladdin.
Sure.
Aladdin, I think, has clearly the special thing there is that graduate students can learn the ropes there. Most other synchrotrons, to some degree Brookhaven still has that too, but they're shutting it down. These newer light sources like the ALS in Berkeley, the APS in Chicago, typically you get 3 days in a row nonstop. And then you get nothing, then in half a year you can come back for another 3 days. Mm-hmm. Here you get 3 weeks. So basically if you go as a graduate student to one of these fancy things, by the time you have everything debugged, the dead time is over. Mm-hmm. And also if you try something new, you know, you may have seen these atom chains that I was making for a while, and still working a little bit on it, where you have to very carefully engineer a silicon surface so that the atoms arrange themselves in particular ways. It takes you a week, just even if you have everything tried in your lab on campus, if you know how to do it and look at the STM, how the structure is, it still takes you that long to reproduce everything, and then you can start taking data. And so that's just the kind of work that I couldn't have done with the ALS. I can do the experiments where I know pretty much in advance what's going to come out and how to do it, and it's all well under control, but sort of the tricky experiments, the more exploratory things, and also just, you know, graduate students having to learn by experience. That's the safest way to learn, or the one you remember the most, that if you made a mistake and you had to work for a week to fix it, and you remember.
Yeah.
If somebody else fixes it for you, So I think that's what the Aladdin ring is really special. The Tantalus ring is really special because it was one of the first rings that was built for users at all. I did my PhD in Germany in Hamburg at DESY, which is the big high energy lab in Germany. And we were so-called, well, we weren't called parasites, but we were called to be operating in the parasitic mode.
Yeah.
And so you see sort of, by the other way, now it has completely turned around. Now the new director is a solid-state physicist of DAISY as of a year ago. And I think they've shut down all high-energy operations. It's all synchrotron radiation there. And so and Stanford has gone almost that way. They have high-energy physics experimentally. The accelerators are pretty much abandoned, and now it's all photon sciences and astrophysics, particle astrophysics. But those are not done at Stanford, those experiments. And those are satellites or mines and things like that. So basically, synchrotron storage rings, light sources, are categorized as first, second, third generation, and the fourth is the one that's coming.
Yeah.
So this parasitic mode was the first generation. And like, for example, the current during my thesis was measured in microamp. I never saw a milliamp there. Then I came to Aladdin and then forgot how much it was. It was maybe 20 milliamps, but it was milliamps, and I was, oh, this is great. And in addition, at the accelerator in Hamburg, they accelerated the beam like 60 times a second and dumped it 60 times a second. So the beam was kind of wildly oscillating, nothing like a stable beam.
Yeah.
And that was also the storage ring. And the most important thing, this was built for solid-state physicists. They were running the show, not the particle physicists, who just randomly change your ring without even bothering to tell you. So that was the second generation, which was built for users. And then the third generation, like the ALS and the APS, they were built not just to produce photons, to produce very collimated photons. So the figure of merit is called brilliance or brightness or something like that, spectral brilliance. And so that's where Aladdin can't really keep up with, although Joe Bisignano improved the brilliance of the SRC probably by a factor of, I would say, 4 or something like that. He really taught an old ring new tricks, but it still can't, you know. If you need sheer brilliance, then you have to go to the ALS or the APS for X-rays. And then the fourth generation that's coming, that will be very fast pulses. So the time becomes it. So peak brilliance will be the new figure of merit. But all these synchrotrons from one generation to the next, usually they improve by one figure of merit by something like a factor of 10,000, 4 orders of magnitude. So the current, you know, went up by 4 orders of magnitude from first to second generation, from like a tenth of a milliamp to an amp, brochium at least. And then the brilliance went up by 4 orders of magnitude from second to third. So I think the Tantalus ring was just sort of the pioneer kind of thing. You'll find lots of people who later on really got established or established a new field of research. You'll find a lot of these people running now synchrotron light sources. There's some statistics how many alumni of the Tantalus ring became eventually synchrotron directors, and there's quite a few.
Yeah.
Wolfgang Eberhard is another one, sort of somebody whom I've gone through from Germany, already being PhD students at the same time, at the same place. He's now, until recently, was the director of the German synchrotron radiation source, BESI, in Berlin. And then Masa Ono, who is on this picture here, he's a big group leader. That's the Ono project, which is a nanoscience, so he's very well known. And Friso is a sort of light source director for the Swiss light source. So I think that's sort of the basic things of Aladdin is the teaching ground for grad students and the place to do sophisticated experiments like Tai Cheng's quantum engineered structures and so on. And Tantalus was sort of the pioneering part of synchrotron radiation physics. That's where sort of the big types of experiments, the techniques were developed, the ideas, how to interpret them.
That's about all I have for now. Is there anything else you'd like to add of your time here as a whole?
Well, you know, I really have good memories, and many other people have very good memories, especially of the, maybe, you know, that we're so far in the distance and everything becomes rosier in the distance. But once in a while I run into people, former colleagues from, not colleagues, but competitors from Bell Labs, and they've become much mellower, and they say, oh, it was so great being in Wisconsin here. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's maybe a side story that's not a sort of a scientific one, but at that time it was a very small group, and it was everyone knew everyone on the ring, and there were many people like me who sort of were stationed here, and so we developed sort of a social life, and there was the famous 4:30 Friday, and we dumped the beer parties and lots of other things. But there was also since most of us postdocs were single, there was also a singles club that we called the Ski Laufers in Madison, and that became very popular, and many people said, oh, maybe some of them, like this particular fellow from Bell Labs, we took him out, and I just think we played volleyball on weekends and went on camping trips up north or to Bean Blossom, Indiana for bluegrass, and so once in a while we, so the people who were on site who really went regularly to these things, events, brought always some people along, and he still remembered many years after. Oh, that was so great. That was social life.